The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on July 8, 1987 in Ipoh, Malaysia. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 12, Text 25.
Yang Vishnu Padang Jitang Twaya Yasurayo Prapya Vichakshate Param Atishta Tachandra Divakaradhayo Grahakshatara Pariyanti Dikshinam. Translation: to achieve Vishnu Loka is very difficult, but by your austerity you have conquered. Even the great rishis and demigods cannot achieve this position. Simply to see the supreme abode, the Vishnu planet, the sun and moon and all other planets, stars, lunar mansions, and solar systems are circumambulating it. Now please come. You are welcome to go there. Translation with repetition. To achieve Vishnu Loka is very difficult. But by your austerity you have conquered. Even the great rishis and demigods
cannot achieve this position.
Simply to see the supreme abode.
The Vishnu planet, the sun and moon, and all the other planets, stars, lunar mansions, and solar systems are circumambulating it.
Now please come. You are welcome to go there. This invitation is given by the representatives of Vishnu, who have come to take Dhruva Maharaj at the end of his life back to Godhead. Prabhupada in this regard gives a purport. Even in this material world, the so-called scientists, philosophers, and mental speculators strive to merge into the spiritual sky, but they can never go there. But a devotee, by executing devotional service, not only realizes what the spiritual world actually is, but factually goes there to live an eternal life of bliss and knowledge. The Krishna consciousness movement is so potent that by adopting these principles of life and developing love of God, one can very easily go back home, back to Godhead. Here the practical example is the case of Dhruva Maharaj. While the scientist and philosopher go to the moon but are disappointed in their attempts to stay there and live, the devotee makes an easy journey to other planets and ultimately goes back to Godhead. Devotees have no interest in seeing other planets, but while going back to Godhead, they see all of them as passing phases, just as one who is going to a distant place passes through many small stations. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta Swami purport, text 25, chapter 12, canto 4, in the matter of Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. Every human being is born in this world to live for some period of time, to produce some byproducts, and eventually we have to leave this material world. Or at least we have to leave this body. Normally when we leave the body, again, we take rebirth. According to our desires, according to our karmas, we achieve a suitable birth in a suitable family. In the modern world, people consider this present life to be the all-important life. They don't worry about their future life, in most cases. And this is a shortcoming of the modern world. Someone may become a prime minister or some very influential president of some country in this lifetime, and he doesn't worry what sinful activities he is performing, what unscrupulous activities he is performing. And in a future life, that although in the previous life he may have been a prime minister or a president, he may even become an animal or any type of very unfortunate birth. They don't worry for that. They live as if there is no tomorrow. This is a shortcoming of the modern world. The Vedic civilization is unique because particularly the codes of ethics, the morals, and the goal of life are all spiritually oriented with an understanding that we are a combination of body, mind, and spirit. And therefore the total individual is taken into consideration. Not simply the body, which is a temporary situation of our life. Not even simply the mind, which is always subject to change, and is also not the absolute platform. But all the three, body, mind, and the spirit. The soul is the actual person, the actual self, which is in the body, which is making the body alive. Without the presence of soul, there is no life symptom anymore. Doctors can confirm that once the life symptom leaves the body, even if you use so many machines to keep the body artificially alive, they cannot perpetually hold back the decomposition of the body. But what is it that differentiates a live body from a dead body? Modern science would say the brain waves stop moving, the heart stops beating. But there's more to it than that. Actually, the living force which makes brain waves and heart beat leaves the body. That is what we call it, death. So in Dhruva Maharaj's case, he never died. None of everybody ever actually dies in the real sense that we cease to exist. We always exist. But we go through this moving from one body to the next. That's what we call it, death. But in Dhruva Maharaj's case, he never had to go through that change. We know Dhruva Maharaj when he was 5 years old, when he was insulted by his father, Uttanapada. He wanted to sit on the lap of his father, but his father pushed him off. Why? Because his stepmother criticized that, why are you favoring your other wife's son and not my son? So because he was very attached to his second wife, he pushed Dhruva off his lap and took the other son of the second mother on his second stepwife on his lap. But Dhruva Maharaj was so insulted. He was so humiliated. He went to his mother and said, can't something be done? What could she do if she's not in favor as a co-wife in that type of situation? What could she do? Nothing she could do. He went to the ministers. What could the ministers do? Whatever the king does, the ministers have nothing to say over it. So he was very upset. He went to different people. Finally, again, he went to his mother and he said, what is the solution? And we know the story, how his mother said, well, there's no one here that can help you. The only one that possibly could help you is God, is the Bhagawan. Now, I don't know exactly where Bhagawan is. I know that the sages go in the forest to find Bhagawan. So maybe he's in the forest. So Dhruva Maharaj, he goes in the forest as a small child, looking everywhere. Where is Bhagawan? Where is Bhagawan? He's going up to the trees. He's going to the rocks. Are you Bhagawan? Are you Bhagawan? He goes up to the tiger. He doesn't have any idea. What does Bhagawan look like? All he knows is this Bhagawan. This Bhagawan can save him, can solve his problem. He is the Supreme Lord. He may look at it anyway. He doesn't know. He's just a small child. He's going up to the tigers. Are you Bhagawan? The tiger is so ferocious in his quest for Bhagawan, even the tiger goes off. In this way, he's looking everywhere, asking everyone. Nobody can help him in the forest. So Bhagawan, all-knowing, Narayana sends Narada Muni to Dhruva Maharaj. So Narada Muni, he appears before Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj sees him. He says, are you Bhagawan? He doesn't know. He says, maybe this is Bhagawan. He just flew in. So then Narada Muni said, no, I am not Bhagawan. But I have been sent by Bhagawan. I am a servant of Bhagawan, Sri Narayana. So I said, well, can you help me to find Bhagawan? I am looking for Bhagawan. Why do you want to find Bhagawan? You're a small child here in the forest. It's very dangerous here. There are snakes, there's wild animals. You should go back to your mother where you can be very peaceful and you don't have to encounter so many difficulties. Listen, Dhruva Maharaj said, you can kindly help me to find Bhagawan, then I'm going to stay here and listen to you. But if you're going to give me all this waste of time, then I'm not going to stay here. I'm finding Bhagawan whether you help me or not. So when Narada Muni could see, he was totally determined. He said, all right, I'll tell you, this is not the way to find Bhagawan. If you want to find him, you chant a mantra. By chanting mantra and meditating, he reveals himself spiritually to the devotee. So I'm going to give you a mantra by which you can meditate and you can find Bhagawan. He'll reveal himself to you in due course of time.
So Narada Muni initiated him into the mantra of that age. Just like in this age, the mantra is Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In that age, the mantra was another mantra. He initiated that mantra into the ear of Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj was chanting that mantra under the formula and guidance of Narada Muni. The Narada Muni disappeared. So everyone knows that as this child, Dhruva Maharaj's meditation was successful. And he was able to see Narayana. But afterwards, Narayana blessed him that you'll be a king for 36,000 years. In those ages, people lived longer. And he was not only the king of one planet, but he was the grandson of Manu. So he had a much larger domain. So then, after living this long period of time as a very successful king, at the end of his life, Dhruva Maharaj, of course, he said that, I don't want this kingdom. I don't want all these things. I want, now that I've desired these things, I've desired broken glass, but instead, I have got diamonds. I have found you. I want to simply serve you purely. I don't want anything else. I have desired things which were insignificant. In other words, by his practice of chanting, even though he had so many desires, when he finally could have the darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, Krishna, then he was so filled with devotion that then he didn't want anything else but to serve Narayana. But Narayana said, since you have desired all these things, I'm going to fulfill all your desires. Don't worry, in the end you will come to me. But even when we serve the Lord, we don't even have to ask. When he finally gives his blessings, we don't even have to ask, that I wanted this, I wanted that, I wanted this. He knows. Every desire we have in our heart, he knows everything we wanted. And he knows how to fulfill those desires better than we do. And he fulfills all the desires. But for the devotee, when they are full in their Krishna consciousness, they don't desire anything else. Because they're full. If you have a full glass of water, you can't put any more water in, it's already full. So although Dhruva, he was now this at the end of his life, he's actually still young and healthy, hasn't gone into old age. Of course, this time we hear in the Vedas about different lifespans, and it seems sometimes amazing because we know we live 100 years. But the whole time in the material world is very relative. For us, we look down at an ant, and we see, what is this insignificant ant? It is living only a few days. But in that few days of an ant life, it goes through the entire birth, childhood, if, you know, its schooling, everything, whatever it goes through the entire cycle. A bird, in the few years it lives, it goes through its entire cycle. Childhood, mating, then old age, finally it dies. Everything, it goes through the entire cycle. If you look at a bird, look at the speed it looks. It's moving its head so fast. It's simply its clock is moved ahead. So that its 100 years goes within 3 years. An ant's 100 years goes within a few days. For the ant, it's moving at such a rapid speed. It's living a full life. So we are looking down at the ant, how insignificant. They're doing all this activity. Just like that, there are entities on higher planets. They're looking at us. Oh, these human beings, what are they doing? They're running around like ants making all these things. So the whole thing is relative. Now we're living in one yuga, one time. In another yuga, there's a totally different time span. Because of irregular habits and so many different, we have a different type of lifespan at this period. So we should understand, when discussing in the Vedas, it talks about other planets, it talks about other yugas, it talks about totally other dimensions in some cases. In that perspective, we can understand everything. So in this case, Dhruva Maharaj, he was at the end of his life. But he didn't have to go through the death process. He was immediately promoted. His material body was transformed immediately into a spiritual body. And he was transferred, going past all of the material planets up to the Vishnuloka. Of course, just as when we see the rockets take off, we lose sight of them after a few miles. On this planet, they certainly lost sight of Dhruva Maharaj after a short time. But other planets where people have greater spiritual vision, it says in the Vedas there are 14 levels of planetary systems. We're on the 7th level. There's another 6 higher levels. And each level higher also has a more piety. And on the higher levels, they also have great psychic and mystic powers. So they can see the future, they can see so many things. So they can also, they could see that Dhruva Maharaj is coming. He's coming, there he is, then he's going, then he's out of sight also. Where did he go? They never saw anyone go so high that they couldn't see. He went to the Vishnuloka, he went back to Godhead. So basically, the ultimate perfection of human life is when we are totally God conscious. When we don't have to go through this cycle again of birth and death. We see in the life of Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who dedicated his life to spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world, to fulfill the instruction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to unify the entire world through the process of Harinama Sankirtan, Sanatana Dharma, the Krishna consciousness. And how he lived his life totally dedicated to this objective. And when he left, he was also completely Krishna conscious, surrounded by his devotees chanting Hare Krishna. He left the mortal frame without any suffering in that pastime, in total spiritual consciousness. So we have heard from so many doctors that when someone leaves the body normally, they're filled with fear and there's many horrible things that happen. Actually, no one should be afraid of what is life if we have proper knowledge. The Vedas are meant to give a human being real knowledge of the world we live in, this life and the life after this life. What is the objective of life? What is the purpose of life? Actually, if you analyze the different social problems, the different causes of war, causes of violence in the world, basically it comes down to a lack of spiritual understanding. For instance, Dhruva Maharaj, at one point in his life, his brother was killed by a group of marauding attackers known as Yakshas. So, in vengeance, Dhruva Maharaj attacked their capital city and declared war on them. And there was a huge battle. Not only were the murder of his brother killed, but so many innocent people were killed in the war. So finally, Manu came with so many sages and they went to see Dhruva. And they said, one person has committed a fault. He killed your brother. We are very glad to know that you have a great affection and sentiment for your brother. But as a person who knows the Vedic principles, who is civilized, why should so many suffer for the sin of one person? Innocent people. So it's not good to declare a war and do all these things excessively over the sin of one person. When so many people who are not connected with that crime, they're all forced to suffer. So then Dhruva Maharaj could see that he made a mistake and he discontinued the war. In this world today, there are so many feuds in Lebanon between Israelis and Muslims and Lebanese and so on. All these things are going on in Ireland between the Protestants and the Catholics and in different parts of the world. It starts off with one thing and then it escalates. And then it goes on like increasing and becoming bigger and bigger until finally there's a massive terrorism, massive destruction in the world. If we bring it back, it's because of a lack of proper understanding of spiritual and religious principles. Even if it's in the name of religion. It was in the name of religious principle, defending his brother's honor and so forth, that Dhruva Maharaj was killing so many Yakshas in war. It was a declared war and so on. But he was thought, what is the use of this? This is not actually the real meaning of a religious principle. Sometimes, in the name of someone may have an idea, this is honor, this is pride, this is religion, and they may do something, when actually, it's not holy, it's not sacred, it's not religious. It's misplaced, improper sentiment. Just as Manu stated that you can defend yourself against an aggressor. Someone attacks you, you can defend yourself. You can even kill an aggressor. And there's no sin. But if someone is not an aggressor, even if he threatens from a distant place, you don't have the right to kill him. There's many examples like this in the Vedas. But if someone doesn't know the Vedas properly, no matter who he is, they have to take the reaction if they act improperly. Unless they're especially excused by the Lord. So Dhruva Maharaj, he had made mistakes, but he was counseled by elders. He accepted, he corrected the mistake, it was absolved. In the end, he went back to home, he went back to Godhead. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his teaching was that everyone in this Kali Yuga is bound to have made many mistakes. If we want to analyze what are the sinful activities that someone has performed, there's no need of going into that. It was bound that people have made mistakes. Because it's the nature of Kali Yuga. How many people are able to be 100% pure? Someone may be 95% pure, someone may be 5%, but some mistake is going to be there. But therefore he said that he will clear away whatever residual karmas are there. He's willing to make a clean slate if someone takes to the process of chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, avoiding the 10 offenses to the holy name. But this is Lord Chaitanya's special mercy. Jagai Madai were two very notorious persons. They were criminals in Navadvip. They were born in a Brahmin family, but later they committed so many heinous activities, murder, rape, robbing, any type of... They were like the mafia of Navadvip, organized crime. They were more than gundas. They were really notorious type, very violent, intoxicated. At the same time, somehow Lord Nityananda was determined to deliver them. So finally, after more than one encounter, when Nityananda had requested them to please lead a holy life and chant the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna. I mean, they were this incorrigible. They thought this was a joke. Madai picked up a broken clay pot, wine bottle. In those days, the bottle, they weren't glass bottles. They would drink the wine in clay pots. So it was a wine pot. He picked it and he smashed it over the head of Lord Nityananda, the associate of Lord Chaitanya. Blood was pouring out. But Nityananda was totally determined that whatever it takes, I'm going to deliver these two brothers. He said, just because you beat me over the head, does that mean that I won't give you love for Krishna? I again repeat to you, you take the chanting of this holy name. The other brother was astonished. They never saw anybody with that much courage, that much conviction, to even be struck, to be mortally wounded, and be still totally determined to help someone else. He told his brother, this person is a real saint. Don't do it. Don't mess around with him. Of course, in the meantime, Lord Chaitanya had heard Nityananda was struck. He came on the scene. At this time, although he was Krishna coming in disguise, trying to remain as a devotee, he couldn't contain himself. He just called the Sudarshan Chakra. Sudarshan Chakra was coming in the sky, brilliant to more than millions of suns. Somehow the two brothers, they came to their senses that they're about to be annihilated, and they surrendered to Lord Nityananda. Nityananda told Lord Chaitanya, don't punish them, because if you punish them, you have to punish everyone. There's two Jagai Madais now, two sinful, dishonest people, but in Kali Yuga there's going to be countless. Give them your mercy. This was Lord Nityananda's mood, giving them mercy. So these two brothers, they begged, alright, we'll do whatever you say, please forgive us. So they were given a clean slate. They were told, take a bath in the Ganges, purify your come back. They were given initiation, but Lord Chaitanya said, on the condition, you don't anymore do any of those sinful activities. Clean slate. But this is the special mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that he cleans all of the karmas of a person, and not only that, but that in this lifetime, this heavenly pleasure or spiritual Vaikuntha happiness that Dhruva Maharaj is experiencing, going back to Godhead, one can already get taste of that nectar by the pure chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Someone gave the example, just like there's a very nice feast I see has been laid out. Of course, here all are adults. But if there were small children, you told the children that now you first you have to take all this vegetables and the sambar and the rasam and everything, or North India you have to take the sukta, sak, chachari, and so on, different preparation. Then at the end, you take the sweet. They become impatient. They want to just go for the sweet first. So the parent may get first a little sweet and then have to give them the vegetable. If the children are impatient, they want to eat first, and especially the sweets. So Prabhupada explained that Lord Chaitanya, he gave first the dessert. He's first giving the nectar. If you chant this Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, if you've practiced this Bhakti Yoga, it's actually so enjoyable that you feel the spiritual happiness. After that, when one is already convinced, because in this age, people want to experience something. They want something which is not simply a theory, not simply words, but something practical they can experience. How is Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada so successful all over the world in spreading the Krishna conscious movement? Not because he simply gave a philosophy, but because he gave a realization. He convinced the people with philosophy and with a practical way of life that produced a result. The result of peacefulness, happiness, contentness, spiritual bliss, in some cases even ecstasy. Because of a real feeling of a change of heart, therefore people could sustain themselves, even though he had very strict principles, that they should avoid all unnecessary violence and meat eating, that they should avoid intoxication and gambling, and they should avoid illicit sex, or that means extramarital Vedic sexual activities. Where in the West, these four activities, actually before Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the guru of our guru, he sent a preacher to London, and he went there in the early 1900s. He had approached certain lords and different people. They said, "We're interested in your philosophy. Your Vedic philosophy is very profound. What do we have to do?" He said, "Well, you should give up intoxication and wine drinking and meat eating and this extramarital sex, and also you should give up gambling." And those lords, they said, "You cannot live without these things. I'll die. This is life. You just said give up life." They couldn't imagine there could be a life without these four activities. You see. Of course, in this modern world, it's very hard for people to follow these activities because it's a whole tradition, it's a whole environment that's come up. And especially when someone has been in a habit for a long period of time, it's difficult to suddenly change. Bhaktivedanta Swami, he first also tried to preach to the very elderly people, but he found that it was very difficult to change their ways. Even though he said, "We agree with you, Phila, we like it, but it will take us some time to be able to change. It's not so easy." So the younger people, somehow they came to him, college students, university students. At that time there were many youth moving around in the West, looking for some solution to many problems that were there in life. And so he started off with a very good group of young people. He moved from the upper part of New York to lower New York. And then many followers came. Then he went to San Francisco, then to Montreal, then London, then to the West. Then he came like this in 5 years. It went all over the West. Then he came back to India in 1970. From India he came here to Malaysia. Then he went to somewhere after that. Also, already before that he was in Japan. Then there was Australia, like this all around the world. When he went to Australia, that time, in Melbourne, the newspaper Age journalist interviewed him at the airport. They said, "Swamiji, you're coming from a poor country, India, to Australia, one of the richest countries in the world, developed nation." And they were like really proud. "So why have you come here? Have you come here to beg aid from us?" Kind of obnoxious question. Prabhupada, he said, "No, I've come here to give you something. I have come here to give you the wealth of our Indian philosophy, of our Vedic knowledge. I have come here to save you from a dog's life." Then they said, "Swamiji, are you saying that we're leading a dog's life?" He said, "Well, a dog is eating, you're eating. A dog is sleeping, you're sleeping. A dog may be eating off the floor, you're eating in a very luxurious restaurant, but eating is the same. Dog is sleeping, maybe sleeping in the street or in the side of the room. You're sleeping on a big bed, but sleeping is it. Dog is having sex, you're also having sex, free love. Then dog is defending, fighting with his teeth and his claws. You're using atomic weapons and jets. So what is the difference? You have a point." So next day, the headline of the Age came. Actually, Prabhupada sent this to me in a letter. I was in Mayapur since 1970 to 79. I'd never left India. But wherever he would go around the world, he would come and spend 2-3 months with me in Mayapur, giving me guidance on how to develop the things in India. And also when he would travel, he would write me regular letters. If I wouldn't write him, after 2 weeks he'd write, "Why have you not written me?" So he wrote one letter from Australia with this newspaper clipping. Unfortunately, someone I think borrowed that from me. I never got it back. But the heading was that Swamiji has come to save us from a dog's life. On the front page. And the subheading was, he has come to hound us. Leonard gave the write-up. They have a good sense of humor. So, actually, Srila Prabhupada, he was type of spiritual revolutionary in one sense. So he was a great ambassador. He would go without any shame, without any shame of the Indian philosophy, with total confidence and honor at the same time, with a good sense of humor, good imagination, knowing how to actually approach the different people in different places. So, of course, we are all feeling the absence of his physical presence here in the world. But he lives on through his books. Over 90 literatures he has left us. Left us the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, which he called as his body, to implement his will in his absence. And he's left us so many gifts. He left us with the desire to continue to spread the Krishna consciousness all over the world. He came here to Malaysia, to Ipoh, grace some of your homes, with the idea that Krishna consciousness would also fructify here. Certainly, many seeds of devotion have been planted here, and that is why many devotees are showing a great enthusiasm for Krishna consciousness over the years. Actually, we have a very great responsibility in the world today. Lord Chaitanya has given a process which anyone can practice anywhere in the world, and very quickly achieve peace of mind, achieve spiritual knowledge, achieve spiritual happiness. This can solve the basic problems in the world. But it requires that those who are awakened, just like if someone discovers that there may be disease in the world, so doctors are researching to find out what is the vaccine, what is the vaccine for cancer, or what is the cure for tuberculosis, or what is the cure for, now they're studying the cure for AIDS or other diseases. They're looking. If someone finds, they'll broadcast to the world, we have it, the vaccination, we have a breakthrough. Even they don't find the vaccine, they find a clue. It goes through all the papers, everyone, oh, there's a hope we can get saved from that terrible disease. So just like that, here there's a disease, the whole world is an illusion, they're all dying and taking again birth. And again, here is the easy way they can all achieve liberation, they can all achieve pure devotion, they can all achieve love of God and go back to the spiritual world. So how urgently this should be broadcasted to everyone. Unfortunately, everyone is focused on the vaccine for cancer, but the vaccine for this type of medicine, people are not really well aware of the depth of the disease. This way, just like there is some disease, sometimes they again and again tell the people this is a dangerous disease. What do you call it? Muscular, sclerosis, or there's so many diseases now that people don't know about. And they're always propagating different foundations. This is a disease. You should all know about it and give your money for solving the researching and finding the problem. So actually, people, they don't know that there is a real problem. They take death for granted. They take old age for granted. They take the suffering in the world for granted. But that's why the Vedas tell us these are kleshas. Kleshas of life. These are sufferings of life. There is a solution for this. But someone has to go and broadcast that to the people. There are problems in life, there is a solution. This is the solution for this time. The Lord Chaitanya, therefore, there's a song which says, Anachi Oshodhi Maya Nashi Varo Lagi. I have brought the medicine to cure the disease of Maya. Hari Nama Maha Mantra Lao Tumi Magi. It is the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Everyone should beg for that. They should request that. They should take it enthusiastically. This will solve their problem. Hare Krishna.
Hare.
Are there any questions? Mr. and Mrs. Vasudevan, have any questions? I think you're asking a very topical question. Something that might be on many people's minds, but they weren't having the courage to. It's a natural question because just as I think since the time of, was it Hippocrates? The physician, heal thyself. Has always been a maxim that the doctors, they expected that just like in the world say that there are something like maybe somewhere between 600 million to 1 billion Muslims. There's roughly about a billion Hindus, and then there's so many Buddhists, and there's so many Christians. If somebody does something, you don't say Muslim did that, or you don't say a Buddhist did that, or you don't say a Christian did that. You say that so-and-so did that. Just like Dhruva Maharaj, one yaksha killed Dhruva's brother. But Dhruva took action against all the yakshas and started massacring yakshas. He was not, why are you doing that? So we find that within that Krishna conscious movement, sometimes a particular individual or a group of one or two individuals, they may act independently, they may make a mistake. They may do something not in the Vedas, not authorized by Prabhupada or by the teachings. They may do something wrong. But what happens is then the entire institution is held responsible for the action of one individual. Sometimes it may not even be an act by a member of the Krishna conscious movement. In some cases they just falsely say that someone did something. In some cases it's real. Someone did something wrong. Sometimes someone left the movement and they did. But now you see, it's not that it's, we have millions of followers. There are millions of followers, adherents to Krishna consciousness. And obviously we can't be responsible for every member that ever comes to any of our programs. But obviously we have to take certain responsibility for persons who are in positions of authority, for positions of responsibility. That's why Prabhupada had created a governing body. He said the governing body should be the watchdog, that in case someone is acting improperly, then he can be officially not recognized. Or in case you cannot take responsibility for someone because of some reason, then you can say. So that the world will be able to understand that who is part of the Krishna conscious movement and who isn't. Who are you saying is acting properly? Now, this is a controversial point. Some members, they were demanding in the past that the governing body has to take action as immediately when there was any kind of doubt or any type of accusation. At the same time, the very same people, when there's some doubt or accusation is in their case, then they protest that, no, I won't accept any type of discipline or any type of regulation. So it's very difficult to run a spiritual movement, admittedly, because everyone is there voluntarily. No one's a paid man, no one's a salaried person. You can't fire anyone. Everyone's there voluntarily. At the same time, how do you maintain a purity? So the only way to do that is that you have a governing body, you have rules, you have a constitution, and then you follow that. So within the movement as it stands, there's no existing leader or guru or sannyasi or that is known to be doing anything either against the law or breaking any of the principles. If it ever comes to light that someone is reported, action is taken, the person is either given, put on some kind of suspension or given a leave of absence or some kind of remedial measure is taken to rectify the person for possible readmission in the future or whatever. But then this has, in turn, then people revolt against that sometime. But if you don't do that, then on the other hand, how do you maintain a purity? You cannot please, it's like either, how do you please everyone? But within ISKCON, this is our principle. We don't break these regular principles. We do follow this principle of purity. And wherever there is a very strong evidence that there is some mishappening, then the governing body takes an action. In fact, this year, after one or two gurus was found out that there was some difficulty, they actually themselves admitted they resigned from their position, and one person was a grihastha. He took sannyas after Prabhupada left the planet. Then afterwards he went back to wife and family. So this is an embarrassment for the whole society that these things happen. You see, of course there was no need for him to take sannyas. We don't recommend it. In fact, now we are reanalyzing why are so many people prematurely taking sannyas. He was married, he had wife, and why did he insisted, no, I must take sannyas. But there was no need for him to take sannyas. He had a wife, he had children, he was already a spiritual master. It was quite good if he could just continued like that. We don't say you have to be a sannyasi to be a guru or to be a leader. You can go on serving as a brahmana, as a grihastha, and you can do that service. But he was, and some others were there, they were all sannyasis. He was a householder, he thought I have to keep up with everyone else or something, and he insisted to be made a sannyasi on his own just by insisting and someone made it, oh, I'll give you sannyas. But after about 4 or 5 years, he was not able to just, you can't just change in 1 week like that and suddenly you're married with wife and you want to become a sannyasi. He wasn't aware of the vast change that you have to go through. You have to prepare yourself. Why is the Vedic system, you go from grihas, you go to vanaprastha, then you go to sannyasa. You give a retired life, you get some gradual withdrawal from, it's one thing if you go from brahmachari to sannyasa. It's another thing if you're already grihasthi with wife and just young children he had. And this wasn't like the whole body said, yes, you can. It was his own just pushing. He wanted to do it. He was a senior member. And his wife at that time said it was all right. But he wasn't prepared. So as a result, you know, we're all suffering. And he's so embarrassed that he's like gone away in one place. He writes letters, but he's ashamed to come forward. And even so, as a result, the people feel deserted that our spiritual master was in this case. And I took a sannyasa in 1970 at the only age of 21. And I've been a sannyasi for 17 years. So I know that I have myself about 9 devotees that took sannyasa from me. And many other God brothers I've guided how to be. And I know it's a very big change. You know, we don't recommend people take sannyasa in this age. You see, it's a rare type of thing. Unless a person has got a very type of austere nature, they don't have all these family entanglements, it's not recommended. So one of the problems has come that these Western, some of the Western devotees, even some, prematurely they take sannyasa. The broad category is that you have some personal weaknesses. It happened. But it's not only that it's happening in the Krishna conscious movement. 20%, in our movement, we keep that everyone has to be pure. If you're a sannyasi in this movement, if any evidence is ever found that you're not maintaining that sannyas vow, immediately that person is put in some kind of a probation or suspension or even told to change his quad. And everyone knows about it because that's the problem. There's nothing kept secret. If someone has a difficulty, the problem is that it gets broadcasted so quickly because our principle is to maintain the purity. I mean, there are religions where we hear 25% of the so-called celibate clergy are all breaking the principles. It's not like that in the Krishna conscious movement. We are following these principles. The few cases you find out about is because immediately those people are exonerated. They're removed or they're told to get married or something is done. Therefore everybody knows about it. But it's a fact. There have been weaknesses. Even in the Madhva Acharya line, recently, 2 of the junior Acharyas from Udupi, they also left their vow and they became married. They got married to the girls that were coming from the Goshala bringing the milk every day, they got attached and they got married. This is going on. It happened. It's Kali Yuga. But that doesn't mean that the people give up Madhva or give up Ramanuja or give up Shaivism because sannyasi doesn't maintain the vow. Then they're not able to remain as a sannyasi. It's having in Buddhism all the time. So monk isn't able, he leaves the monkhood. That doesn't mean that the Buddhism stops or Buddha's teachings are not valid. Prabhupada is maintaining. So many sannyasis are maintaining. We have 100 sannyasis in Krishna. It's not that one or two may have had some difficulty. Even our senior ones may have had difficulty. Others are going on. This is happening. The sannyas itself is forbidden in the Kali Yuga. So mostly the problem you find is simply this problem of sannyas. So the first part is the personal weakness that someone may have. But that's brought the whole society. We have got right now 350 branches. We got maybe 20,000 to 50,000 active members. We got 75,000 life members. And you got thousands and millions of people chanting in their home different things. So if one or two people have a difficulty, even if they're senior people, that can't be said the whole Krishna conscious movement should be then declared as some way invalid or something. It's a growing movement, but it's a vast worldwide movement now. And there's bound to be that some difficulties that come up. Those are spontaneously being corrected. And things are going on. Now the other part is there, which is also a valid point, which is sometimes maybe overused, as you said, as Kali Yuga, or another thing is also there. Sometimes there is governmental and official persecution. In Russia, we are being persecuted. There's no doubt about it. Our devotees are arrested there. There are different persecutions. Now if you say the Krishna consciousness, why it's being persecuted in Russia? Nobody will say, everyone knows why it's being persecuted in Russia, because it's a communist country and it's being there are many other countries which I wouldn't mention in this country for various reasons. We're also not able to publicly practice Krishna consciousness. Due to a very type, maybe religious or political or different biases. Now, for instance, in France, our movement there has still the similar amount of devotees. But what has happened is that the government of that country, which is basically socialistic oriented, which has recently put a lot of restrictions on the Roman Catholic schools and other things, when we submitted our income tax returns in that country, the report we got is that they went and they said, all right, you're not liable to income tax, but you've sold over the years so many millions and millions of francs worth of books. These are sales taxable. You owe us 15 million francs of sales tax. Now, how do we know, I mean, the Bibles, we're giving out our Bible, Bhagavad Gita book, and taking donation for that. We're getting donation. They said, no, this is not a donation. This is a sale. We're giving the book, we're playing, please give a donation. People give a donation. We put that in the church fund. They're saying, no, that's a sale. That's not a donation. We don't accept. You owe a sales tax. So that money has already been invested in big temple and different things. Now, one temple we had leased. That lease, at the present time, the government put serious restrictions on us. We can hardly function, can no longer sell books in that country in the same way. There's a number of things we had to totally change the different modus operandi. As a result, and also due to other problem, there was also a change of leadership. But mainly the government, because of this sale, there's no reason to lose that building that you saw in the picture at the start. There is no reason to lose that building except for this income tax, or sales tax problem. And that sales tax is right now under the court. And now we're trying to negotiate that if the government wants to take away their temple and auction it off to gain the money for their sales tax, that somehow from another country, if we can buy it and preserve it for Prabhupada. We're trying to look into that. But I know that even the one Maharaj from that temple is trying to go and donate the cows of that temple to Tirupati, because they also afraid that the government, if they take the temple, they may also take the cows and slaughter the cows and sell them for slaughter to get money for their sales tax. And they're so afraid that these cows are part of our Goraksha program. Now, this could never happen in certain country. I don't think it could happen in America. I don't even think it could happen in Malaysia. It certainly could never happen in India, that they're going to take you sales tax for selling Bhagavad Gitas and sell your temple and slaughter your cows. But under this attack, basically what happened, the devotees said, they said, well, there's no use of having a big temple in this country because the government's going to take it away from us at the present time. So what they're doing is they're dividing into many small centers. Many of them are doing home programs, and they're becoming chanting in their altars in their homes in different programs in smaller centers around the country. And so the newspapers, from their point of view, the Krishna consciousness is disappearing, because at one big center with hundreds of devotees, they don't see them anymore. The devotees haven't stopped practicing Krishna consciousness, but they've changed their modus operandi because they're basically being attacked by the tax people. And the government in France, the law is you're guilty until proven innocent. Everyone knows that it's the opposite of the English system. England, you're innocent until proven guilty. There, you're guilty until proven innocent. All the vehicles there have got a government thing on it. It's all leaned by the government. Everything has already been taken by the government. If they prove themselves innocent, then they can have it back. So they're worried. What are they going to do? They have deities there. I mean, in most countries, you can't take over a church. You can't sell off a church like that. They have their deities there, the Radha Madhav Govinda Nitai Gaur deities. The devotees are making a plan now. If the government takes the chateau, New Mayapur, to where to put the deities. So we've had a meeting in Sweden about this. This is what the governing body does. We had a little meeting regarding what to do in this, and some special people have been sent there, some leaders, to go and study the whole legal situation, talk with the government, see what can be done. Maybe it's a misunderstanding. Maybe someone made a mistake. We don't know all the details. So we sent some people there. They're going there to see the whole situation. But I mean, this happens sometimes in these governments. They don't want that this type of new spiritual movements as we're considered in the West, because it's new to the West. It's not new to India. It's not new to Malaysia. This is the Indian culture, it's not new. Chanting mantras, worshipping Krishna. Maybe the organization is new, but the process is not new. But for them, the whole process is new. So they call it new religions. So, or cults, or sects, or so on, so they try to lump us into some kind of a bad situation. So we have to face all these things. And we've already faced it in America years ago. They tried to ban us. We took it to the Supreme Court, and they declared us as a bona fide religion. That's why we have some certain amount of status in the United States, because we had to fight it up to the Supreme Court. And Prabhupada was personally there directing the fight. Now, as far as Indonesia is concerned, Gorgomondo Bumi is actually the regional secretary of Indonesia. He would be able to personally explain the difficulty. All the devotees there are very sincere. I don't find any fault on their part, but it was some internal, you can call it politics, because Krishna Khan was spreading very broadly. Some of the basic, the Shivaites there or something like that, they didn't understand that we're not against Shiva, or we also respect Shiva and everything, but somehow there was some internal problem caused by some other groups that felt threatened by our going and spreading so rapidly. So they made some complaint. This type of thing, you can't say that, well, why is this happening? Because this happened time of Lord Chaitanya. When Lord Chaitanya was preaching in India, Navadvip, the brahmanas went to approach to the Chankazi and said, we have to stop Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although he is preaching pure Krishna consciousness. He's going to destroy Hindu culture because he's having the chandalas and the sudras and the vaishyas and all with the brahmanas, and all together they're chanting. He's going to destroy our caste system. They felt threatened by Lord Chaitanya's movement. Later, they could realize their mistake, that actually Lord Chaitanya was reviving the Vedic culture. He was purifying it. But in the beginning, people didn't understand. So Indonesia is very new. Even newer, you can say, than Malaysia in the terms of here it's since 1970 when Prabhupada came. I don't know if Prabhupada ever went to it. He also did. 73. But there's a good chance that that'll be all normalized very soon. In one sense, they have published the Bhagavad Gita in Bahasa Indonesia, whatever, and they have done so many wonderful works. The devotees are all practicing there. So some of these things are actually simply like kind of persecution, misunderstanding. In Chile, our society was deregistered. But in Chile, I mean, it's a total dictatorship, and they do anything they want. And they didn't want that the Hare Krishna movement should be registered in that country. The Roman Catholic Church, if someone put some pressure, they just deregistered it. There's no human rights there. You can't make any. You don't even dare say, we don't even complain about it, because they'll just arrest you. Is this a total police? But because, all right, the people are there generally very mellow, and we don't break any laws. We go on there, now we're registered not as a religion, but as an educational. We teach yoga, this, that, we reorganize in different ways. Going on, we have thousands of followers in Chile. Government is not disturbing us anymore. I go in Chile in my dhoti, and they allow me admission, give me visa, there's no public. But they took away our official registration as we were before. Now we have a different registration under different names and different things. We're functioning in a different way. Actually, what happened, we applied to be registered as a religion. We were registered as an educational, cultural movement. When we applied for religion, then the church heard about it. They said, no way, we don't want another religion in this country. And then they took away our registration. So I told them, you should not have applied for registration as a religion. What was the need? We're going on as a cultural society. After all, we're teaching culture also. So there are some places like this where you get persecuted. And this may get broadcasted. No one will broadcast about Chile or Russia, because who cares? Everyone knows that these countries, there's no human rights. But if something happens in France, people don't know, so they broadcast it. But any devotee, any life member, it's very good. You shouldn't be shy about it. We'll tell you what's the truth. We're not going to hide the truth. They will tell you, a devotee had this spiritual problem, and this is what's been done to correct it. Or, no, there's no spiritual problem amongst the devotee, but we're being persecuted in this way. We'll tell you what the thing is. Maybe, because I know there's a very small group, I'm speaking public, we may not always speak to our life members. We'll certainly tell them. You can, in this way, hand it down to the other people. It's not that we're not a secret movement. We're very open about what we're doing, and we're not against explaining anything that's going on. But they don't say that how, for instance, in Australia, how everything is going very nicely and how many thousands of books are being distributed and devotees are being made. They're not saying how in India we had 700,000 people for the Rath Yatra in Calcutta, how 10 lakhs of people are going to be coming to the Janmashtami festival in Bombay, or how 6 million people came for the 1 month festival in Mayapur for the 500th anniversary of Lord Chaitanya, how Rajiv Gandhi inaugurated the 500th anniversary celebration in Delhi simultaneously with me in Calcutta. At that time was Zail Singh, the president of India, inaugurated the 500th anniversary of Lord Chaitanya in Calcutta in the Ravindra Sarovar Stadium. How Krishna conscious representatives from East and West India were the chief guests with the President and Prime Minister of India. These are not being broadcasted here in Malaysia. These are not being told to the life members or to the public. How so many wonderful things are going on. How we're building the first actual Vedic temple in Lima, Peru in South America. Or how they have a beautiful Sitaram deity is now in a big spacious farm in Brazil, how there's 20 centers there, and how the big temple was opened in South Africa in the midst of all these difficulties in Durban. Has that picture ever been put? The picture of Paris is being put. Has the picture of Durban, South Africa ever been put in the star? You see, this is the thing. And information is given in the wrong ways many times. So I very much appreciate this question. And certainly we do have these type of problems. Some are real personal problems that have come up. And once this was asked to Prabhupada, in a spiritual movement, how can this be? How is this possible that someone will have a difficulty? Prabhupada said it's a miracle that someone is able at all to follow these principles. No one can follow these principles in the whole world. What leader, what head of state is following these principles? That anyone can follow, that itself is a miracle. It's not unusual that somebody has a difficulty maintaining sannyasa or something. That's not how someone is able to maintain, that is an incredible thing in this age. That shows some spiritual potency is there. Some difficulty may come. It's a fact. Because we are declaring war with Maya. Someone is a little bit careless. Said spiritual life is like a razor's edge. If you make a little mistake, you cut yourself. So someone who acts carelessly, they have to, but that doesn't mean that they're also finished. They can continue on in their spiritual life in various ways, and they can again become glorious. Krishna says in the Gita, even if someone who is a devotee commits an abominable act, he should still be considered saintly. Because he's a devotee, in the end he'll come back to me, I'll correct his mistake. If someone, we welcome people, whoever you are, come and chant. So someone may come, they may be a criminal before. They may act again criminally. We have to say, no, you cannot act as an active member. That doesn't mean that their service was wasted. Whatever they did for Krishna, they never lose that. That will bring them back to Krishna eventually, and they can go on serving. But maybe we cannot accept them in its official status because of their mistake. But if they act properly, then we can accept. Is that clear now? The point is that Prabhupada started a certain system in ISKCON, that he was the first founder Acharya. And then as a movement, he's 65, he started 1971, he said, now the movement has got so many centers. In order to supervise the centers, I'm going to appoint some zonal secretaries. And they're going to oversee the activities in a particular zone. And he first appointed 11 and gradually it increased. By 1977, there were about 25 zonal secretaries. I was also made one of the zonal secretaries at that time for West Bengal and Orissa and parts of Eastern India. Later, after 78, I was given South India. Since then, I've been working there. Then, in Bangladesh and Nepal, Prabhupada was my regional secretary. He was connected before with Malaysia and other parts. So when Hansaduta had his own spiritual difficulties at that time, then I was asked to take responsibility to see that the movement would go on nicely here in Malaysia. Now, the basic system is that the opening of a temple or a center is that to be recognized by the ISKCON body should be approved by the GBC zonal secretary. If someone wants to open a center, I mean, in terms of Malaysia, we have a society here called the Society of Krishna Consciousness of Malaysia, and they have their own governing body. It's a totally Malaysian affair. And they sometimes ask me for advice, but basically they have a system where they can have branch offices, like they have now a branch in Bukit Mertajam, a different place. Now nobody, since what happened, you see, originally Rohini Kumar came to Ipoh, and he approached me with Rahugana Das, that we want to be recognized by you as a zonal secretary and make this a bona fide center. We don't want to work independently. We want to be working in a proper way, cooperatively. That's why he invited me. I came up here. And there, you might have remembered there was quite a good friendship. And no different. Suddenly, our only fear was that being a foreigner in this country, whether he would be able to stay or not. And so while we were discussing the formalization of this as a branch or something like that, he suddenly had whatever difficulty, visa or some personal problem, he decided to leave this place and go back to America. Now he's working, I believe, in our Berkeley temple of ISKCON, so far that I know. No, he's good standing, there's no... So then at that time, you also approached that, all right, since this somehow had begun, then we... At that time, I tried to encourage Yadavendra to stay here. Now, after Yadavendra left here, I didn't get any more report. I was a bit busy because this year I've kind of readjusted my whole program. Previously, I would spend half my time outside of India, half my time in India. But this year now, I've readjusted that I'm going to be spending about 4 months, 15 months every month in Mayapur. And then the rest 4 months I'm going to spend between other parts of India and Malaysia and all these places and traveling, and only 4 months outside of Asia. So, and also we've reorganized Mayapur to make it as a city organization. I've been very busy with our Mayapur organization because we have about 300 devotees there, and we have a very big program to make the largest temple in Asia in Mayapur. And so I was busy. In the meantime, I didn't get any information about, but maybe Prabhupada Vishnu Maharaj did or not, I'm not sure, of any formal request to recognize a branch here in Ipoh. You know, we know that Yadavendra left. After that, as far as I know, there was no formal request for making a branch here in Ipoh. Now the thing is that somehow it's been like a type of karma that in Ipoh, you know, the devotees have been so enthusiastic for the Krishna Khan that anywhere they can get the Krishna Khan, they just, you know, they go on taking it. And I think that's their good credit. At the same time, yeah, we feel that in Malaysia, in a country where even the Indian population is a minority, that we should try to avoid as much confusion as possible. And things should be done in as much a coordinated manner, as authorized manner as possible. So, but that would require the cooperation of all the members here also. That when there is a difficulty, since in most countries maybe there's one zonal secretary, here you've got two, you have Prabhupada Vishnu Maharaj and myself, and you also have a society here, where Bhakti Bhajan Anand Maharaj is the chairman, and there are other, you see, officers. Actually, our general secretary recently elected is here also today. Shingeshwar Das Brahmachari. And also our Vija Gauranga Das Adhikari from Bukit Merkajam. He's also a central council member. And actually, there's a need to have someone from Ipoh on the central committee of the society and to make this as a proper branch in it. But for one reason or another, I think that there's maybe been a lack of communication from both the sides, possibly. I don't know, but I know I haven't got up-to-date information that, for instance, there was a need here to again start the center. So maybe because I've been busy in India at this time, that's why. Because I can't give my full attention, I'm coming mainly part-time just to encourage the devotees. So Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj, he's the other devotees are there. These things should be brought up in the either the Malaysian level or the GBC level, the zonal secretary level, that we can solve the problem. But the problem is that in this particular case, sometimes what happens is that the devotee just goes and opens up a center or something, and then we don't even officially know. We may know that he's doing it, but it's not like coordinated or anything. We don't want to dampen anyone's enthusiasm. We don't like to interfere with someone's own practice of Krishna consciousness. Now in the case of Kirtananda Swami, you know, I don't know if it's a proper forum to discuss this thing in the public like that, because I don't want, it's a very sensitive issue. But there is a kind of a thing that has to be worked out on a much higher level. I'm personally everyone that is acquainted with this thing knows that I have a very great respect for Kirtananda Swami, and I'm very concerned that whatever the difficulty that's going on right now could be solved. But because of some legal problems that came up in New Vrindavan, and some basic problems of this, like this, because in our society we have a rule that if you want to open up a branch, you should do it under the auspices of the local authority. Now if you just go and open up a branch without telling the local authorities, then how they can be responsible? Now if something goes wrong, then the people are going to think this is the Hare Krishna movement. But they're not actually working under the local authority. And even from the secret police or other people, if they make some investigation, because in this society you're not allowed to have public meetings, you're not allowed to have an office unless you're a registered society. And so are they the Krishna conscious society? No, because they never registered, they're not working under the central council. Have they ever applied to the central council of the Society of Malaysia? Have they ever gone through any of the formalities that are required by the register of societies to become a branch? Have anything, I mean, we have a book at Meritajam, there's no full-time devotee there, but there are about 12, 15 disciples. They form their own society branch there. They have regular meetings. They have a house. And they also have preachers go there and give Sunday program. They also give. And they're quite happy. Would you say you're happy? You could talk to these other members that they're quite happy working under the legal framework of the society here. Now, I think that the members in Ipoh, if they would work under the legal framework, this would be very good for us in the public and the government and all the respect. And we could try to engage everyone appropriately under the legal framework in a coordinated way. But if it goes on, you know, totally I could understand. I've never been invited to the center. I thought that when Yadavendra left, maybe that center had closed down or something. I hadn't been informed up to date what has really happened. I only heard, actually, on the way here, Prabhupada Vishnu Maharaj told me, actually, that there was a center here, and he was invited to go to it, but he was a bit shy to go, because not being an official center of the society, that if he goes, he's somehow giving some official recognition to it, when actually it should go through the national council that they have in this country, and it should go through that. He didn't want to personally take sides or something. If somebody wants to open up a center and not have it done in an official way, then maybe the other members who are going through the normal procedures there and in one way being prejudiced against. So he was a bit shy that even he mentioned to me that there was a center, but that was just mentioned on the way here. I didn't even know it before. And I'm only hearing from you now that it's in the same house it was before, which makes sense because that was not a bad house. So there are some difficulties here, and I don't know if this is the appropriate form to discuss it, but that's why I'm staying here tomorrow morning, that hopefully some of these things could be worked out. And although there was a very tight program in other places, many places wanted me to visit, but we made a point to come here to Ipoh so that we could discuss and try to work out and make a more lasting kind of arrangement, because I know that you're all sincere devotees. I know that Ram Tulsi is also certainly trying to do something to spread the Krishna conscious movement in his own side. Now, the problem that's coming with Kirtananda Swami is that previously he would always discuss with me, but in this case he didn't directly ever discuss with me about opening up any branches in the society. In the meantime, because of all the legal problems and some other difficulties, which I don't want to get into all the details now, but this is in Mayapur, basically the governing body said they couldn't take responsibility for what he was doing under the present circumstances, so they've officially said that he's not part of the Krishna conscious movement. If he wants to be part, then he should contact the secretary of the GBC, and then they'll make the necessary, they'll discuss the things, and make some arrangement that he could be re-recognized as a part. Now, to go into all the reasons why, I don't want to do that in public, and I don't know if even necessary to do, because it's very sensitive for me and for everyone. But if it's necessary, we can discuss it, but then maybe that should be done amongst, you see. But the problem is that, I feel that he should make a step to go and be recognized back as part of this country. Whatever, if they made a mistake or they were dealing very quickly, but there are definite, on both sides, there are some definite problems that were there. Two murders were found in New Vrindavan, and a person was convicted of murder, and there's another murder happened after that, and there's every chance that people will be convicted. And the society just wanted that there should be some kind of interchange. Now, I personally thought that there was a better way of doing it, maybe, but my individual opinion doesn't really count after the decision is made. I had an opinion that we should have maybe done something else, not ask him to be not a part of this camp, but suspend him or something like that. I actually said that. People even know that. I didn't agree with voting that he shouldn't be part of this camp. But once the vote was made, majority, because we follow by this type of a governing body, all right, then it was said, all right, why was it made that way? Because we can't be responsible. What is suspension? We don't have the system of suspension and probation in this camp. You're either a member or you're not a member. You either follow the authority or you don't follow. So right now, he's not a member. If he wants to be a member, we'll re-recognize him. That's the way they want to do it. I didn't agree with that system, but since they made the thing, who am I? I can't go against it. We may feel hurt. We may feel it was a very abrupt way of dealing. But they also have their reasons why they did that. And I understand the both sides of it. But I feel that somehow we should all request Kirtananda Swami to be part of the Krishna conscious movement. Even if they acted abruptly, there were reasons why they did that. There are problems that happened in New Vrindavan. There is a lot of public media coming about New Vrindavan more than any other part of the world. There's a lot of good work they're doing there also. But somehow this thing has to be settled on a higher level. And if Kirtananda Swami wants to make a total separate movement and have a branch in Malaysia and a branch in India and a branch and make his own worldwide movement, how are we going to interwork? It's a big question mark in all of our minds that if once a preacher wants to himself make a totally separate movement, it's going to be very confusing for the people. There are good points maybe that we have competition, but if there's competition, this also means that there's going to be some difficulty. There's going to be competition, there's some misunderstanding. We're both preaching the same philosophy. Why should we compete with each other? Why shouldn't we cooperate with each other and each work in our own way? Now, I always supported Kirtananda Swami when he had a disciple in South India, Andhra Pradesh. He said, I want to open up a center there. I said, you have my permission. And my disciples were there and his disciples. Not that there's a group here, Acharyapad disciple, Hansa Guru disciple, or Bhaktipad disciple. It's not like that. In our society, we have 60 gurus. Anybody can take initiation from any guru they want. Here now, Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj has been a guru. There'll be also Malaysian gurus coming up, and we hope in the very near future. And anyone can take initiation from whom they want. But as a society, we work as one unit. We work as one team. Now, at the present moment, Kirtananda Swami is not officially part of the society because of all various reasons that I mentioned. We want that he should come back. We want that he should be recognized back. We want that to happen. But I feel that the more that he opens up separate centers, the more that there's confrontation, the more that there's competition, what happens is that it's like burning the bridges. Then people raise different, then to substantiate what he's doing, he has to say, oh, I don't believe in the Krishna conscious movement, it's dead, this, that. We're not dead, we're here, we're alive, we're still going on. You know, whatever we're doing, we're trying to do in our own way. I also respect him, he's an empowered preacher, he can do many things. But this type of criticism, counter-criticism, is going to go on if people have to take their stand. He is a disciple of Prabhupada. Why doesn't he work with all the other disciples of Prabhupada? I'm sure that this can be worked out. But all the members should request him. Work together with ISKCON. Work out the difficulties. This will inspire all the life members. This will inspire everyone. I am there to do whatever I can to see that the differences are worked out. But if he's adamant that he doesn't want to work with part of ISKCON, I agree to work in this institution started by my spiritual master, which has got all these branches and all these sincere devotees all over the world, Guru Mandal Bhumi, Prabhu Vishnu Maharaj, different devotees all over the world, hundreds and thousands of devotees. I don't feel that I want to separate myself from that society. And even if I was dealt with in a very harsh way, I think that I would, after a while, after being a bit offended and everything, I would also request to please be forgiven and please request to somehow work out the difficulties and work cooperatively again, knowing that this would be more pleasing to Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, the proof of how much you love me is how well you cooperate together after my absence. So I'm sure that you can find difficulty, you can find some complaint from different sides. But on the bottom line, all of us, especially those who believe in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, believe in Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada's teachings, we should find a way to cooperate together. We should find a way to work the one teamwork, not in a type of discoordinated manner. Of course, you being all Grihastha devotees living outside, you don't know about all these matters. So that's why I'm telling you in a kind of a nutshell, not in a detailed way. But since you are actually very senior Grihastha devotees, people have been connected now practically going on for a couple of years, you should become a little more acquainted with the situation and then make a very sincere decision. And in this way, we can work in a more coordinated manner. I'm in one sense, I tell you, I'm a very tolerant person. But in other parts of the world, if this would happen, the zonal secretary would be furious. That how is it that centers are going on and being created and he doesn't know anything about it? It's not formally registered. Even governmentally, you just can't have branches coming up where it's not legally registered. It's against the law, it's against the society, and it's against our own spiritual principle. But I haven't made any complaint because I don't want to offend you. I don't want to offend Ram Tulsi. I don't want to offend Kirtananda Swami. But I'm coming here to request everyone that we should understand what is the higher principle. We should work out something that we can actually work properly under the systems given by Srila Prabhupada, under the systems of the laws of this country. And this way we should try to see that we can make a permanent center in Ipoh, which is going to go on continuously. There's never been a branch registered here in Ipoh, and that's a problem. Different foreign devotees have come here, devotees from other cities have come here. I think if you talk here with Jagannath Vallabh Das and Dvija Gauranga,